Good day, everyone. This is Larry Bonchek with another in our series of conversations with pivotal figures in the development of Lancaster General Hospital. My intention in this series is twofold. First, I hope these conversations will enable you, our listeners, to become better acquainted with the backgrounds, personalities, interests, and perspectives of some of these leaders. Second, and more important in the long term, I trust that as these conversations accumulate, they will comprise an oral history of Lancaster General Hospital. With those objectives in mind, the following interview is with Paul Waddell, the individual who, while president and CEO of Lancaster General Hospital, was irrefutably the central figure in the evolution of the extraordinarily successful enterprise that Lancaster General is today. Arriving here in 1964, at a time when LGH was a rather typical, one might even say ordinary, community hospital, he retired after a long and exceptional tenure, during which he guided the hospital through a remarkable transformation into an institution with a national reputation, highly regarded not only for its clinical excellence, but also for its financial stability. He then went on to develop and lead the hospital campus for the following 2 years. Paul had quite an extensive resume before coming to Lancaster. He has a bachelor's degree from American University in Washington and a master's degree from Northwestern University. He was in the Navy at the end of World War II as a medical corpsman stationed at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and then was called back into the service during the Korean War, where he again was at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And it's after that Navy experience that he entered the career that brought him eventually to Lancaster. After completing his training at Northwestern, he was at Polyclinic Hospital in Harrisburg, and then at Williamsport Hospital, where he was an assistant administrator from 1954 to 1959, and the administrator of that hospital for the next 5 years between 1959 and 1964, at which time he was offered the opportunity to come to Lancaster, and the rest is history, as they say. In addition to his career as a hospital administrator, Paul has a very complete life with 4 children, 8 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, and a distinguished career in civic service with the Red Cross, the James Buchanan Foundation, the Lancaster Chamber of Commerce, and the American College of Healthcare Executives, where he was a regent. Paul, it is a great honor and privilege to have you here. I'm just delighted you accepted this invitation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
I'd like you to tell us, first of all, when you came here, what was it like?
I lived on the 3rd floor of the West Wing, which was vacant. 2 weeks after I was on the job, at 5 o'clock in the morning, I got a call from Dr. Robert Krissinger that my chief financial officer was dead. The next thing surprises I had was my secretary only worked 4 hours a day, that's all. And the hospital books were kept on a cash accounting basis, not an accrual accounting basis.
Well, Paul, let me interject for the benefit of our audience of non-accountants. With accrual accounting, if I'm not mistaken, transactions accounted whenever the transaction takes place, even if payment isn't actually received yet. So you don't have to wait until the money is actually transferred to record a transaction. But in the cash method, income isn't counted until the money is actually received, and expenses are not counted until they are actually paid. Well, I know that accrual accounting is the more common method, Paul, so what did you do?
I called my father, who is a CPA and had many fine government jobs, appointments by Mr. Truman. And he said, call Larry Carroll of Pete Marwick in Philadelphia. I called him on the phone, and he said he thought it was my father, And he said, I'll be there tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Well, he was here the following day. They, I learned later, were the auditors for Armstrong, so I didn't get any static about calling an auditor in here. My secretary stayed on until I had a full-time secretary. I was on the job here now 3 weeks, and two gentlemen from labor and industry walked in, and they said they'd like to inspect the hospital. So we walked around. In the old building that faced on Lime Street was open stairwells and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they said, you've got patients in here. You'll have to get the patients out of here as quickly as possible. This was ward patients. So, and they didn't want to put them in private rooms. I put them all in private rooms. On the ground floor was the emergency room, social service, and the pharmacy. On the second floor, the connecting wing between the Lime Street building and the Duke Street building was the radiology department, which you can't believe the conditions of the radiology department.
You're implying that the facilities themselves were inadequate.
Absolutely. They had no personnel policies, no pension plan. After a discussion with the board several times, they said to buy all the property in the confines of Lime and Duke and Frederick and James, inside that place. So I was buying real estate as much, paying $20,000 for houses on James Street. We needed it for parking. And we decided, after much trials and tribulations, to build a student nurse's residence. We tore two buildings down on the west side of Lime Street, and that's where the decision was made to locate the student nurse's residence. We used all government money for it. I got a Hilburton grant of $700,000+, and then bonds, 3% government bonds, financed the balance of it. We started full-time doctors in the emergency room, Dr. Johns, Stoner, Dunkel, and Moberg. And then it was July 1st of 1966, Medicare walked in, which meant a lot of more money for the hospital. Prior to that, we were getting paid $3 and $4 a day for ward patients. That's all the state was paying for us.
What was the financial stability of the institution like before Medicare?
It wasn't too stable, Larry.
But you were able to buy up the real estate.
Yeah.
I mean, so you had some wherewithal. Yeah. Purchases were not financed. One of the striking things about this hospital to me during all my years here is its propensity to pay as you go. In other words, when something is needed, it's important to the hospital administration, and basically this was your administration, to be able to pay for it and not have to borrow huge sums of money. In other words, we expanded as we could afford to expand.
That is very true, and I guess you can attribute that to my being raised during the Depression. I didn't spend money unless I had it, and Mr. Barley used to tease me about that. He was from one of my chairmen of my board.
From Barley Snyder.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Ralph Barley, fine gentleman, had a new pension plan started on February 1st of 1967. We had a capital campaign to build the North Wing. During all these years that I was here, we had Joint Commission on Accreditation approvals. We never got smacked for being underserved or anything like that. Every year, we met all the criteria. We broke ground for the North Wing on January 25th of 1968. And with that construction, we air conditioned the lower four floors of the Duke Street building. And at the same time, we installed all new windows, steel, replacing the steel casement windows.
Now let me, if I can, redirect your comments a little bit towards the nature of medical practice. We've talked about the bricks and mortar. But when you came here, that era in American medicine, particularly in the smaller towns, there were a lot of people doing specialty work who were not board certified in the specialties. LGH, like many hospitals, had to go through a transition. And I would imagine that that wasn't always an easy one.
No, it wasn't. But with the encouragement from the medical staff, and we had some younger physicians coming back asking for privileges, and finally it was accepted that some of these procedures that the staff was currently doing should be undertaken by the younger men and not with the existing staff.
Well, I know I came here in 1983, and by then there certainly were no practitioners doing anything that they didn't have board certification to do.
No, from John Polson was a neurosurgeon, Jimmy Argiers came in, Dr. Mann, Dr. John Espenshade had just returned from England and Guy's Hospital in London. Then we build that cath lab. Every time I was turned around, I was working with the architect to add or trying to buy some property or tearing a building down. And then at the same time, trying to work on a pension plan, work on employee personnel policies. It was just, I had more balls in the air than you can ever believe, and trying to keep them all balanced and keep peace in the family at the same time, because there was a lot of turmoil, and the more you do, everybody gets a little shaky. What's going on here? It worked out, I will say this. It was trying at times, but it worked out.
Joseph Schumpeter, who was a great student of capitalism, some consider him the greatest in the 20th century, introduced the phrase creative destruction about the economy. The internal combustion engine does away with buggy whip manufacture. The process in a hospital is continuous creative destruction. Some new technology comes in and replaces something older. Somebody is made uncomfortable who was doing it the old way.
They sure are. And we had educational programs. Dr. Zavanis came in, and with the board's encouragement and the medical staff, we established a residency in family practice, and it's been very successful. And I credit Dr. Zavanis. The Steinman Foundation have been great to this institution, both the John Frederick and the James Hale. We've turned around, we got the cobalt initially, then we got the linear accelerator, then the second linear accelerator, the cath lab, and each one of these levels brought more and pushing for better and better all the time.
You just say it like that because you're not taking personal credit, but I think it's fair to say that your own imperative always was that this hospital can be better than it is.
Oh, you can always do better tomorrow than you've done today. Always. If you think about that, you know, I can't do better. Yes, you can. Try a little harder.
Well, and I think that always was the philosophy in terms of management as well. We can get even more efficient. We can lower our costs even further. And now that's a question, since we're on that subject, that I think is important to ask. And that is that even though this hospital is renowned for its financial success, the patients don't see high charges.
No. The institution here, if you check the annual Pennsylvania Cost Containment Council and check our charges versus somebody else's charges, not cost, because you can't compare cost. And you'll find that we're the lowest cost institution for our size in the state. And our profit, for a better term, and you have to have a profit. Let's understand.
No question. You have to have profit. Even in a nonprofit institution, there's profit. It's just a question of what you do with it that makes the difference.
We used to try to have a Lancaster County Hospital Council. I instituted that, where the chief executive officer and the chairman of the board of the four county hospitals would get together and chat, and so that we weren't fighting with one another.
Confronting one another.
I like that. We got into some group purchasing. Simple things, you know, whether it's paper towels or toilet paper, simple things that if we buy as a group, you could get a better price on it. We dedicated the 10-story North Wing in 1971, and then Vic Augusta came to me from urology and said to me, "What do you know about lithotrip?" And I did some work in trying to find out about it, and got all the hospitals, the urologist, the chairman of the board, and the chief executive officer. We all met over in Hershey, and I expressed to him that I think it's Dr. Romer. He wanted a lithotripter there, and would in the area hospitals, Reading, York, Harrisburg, Lancaster, urologists from these institutions would be able to use the lithotripter over there, because it was very expensive. One hospital couldn't support it. Together we could support it. Everybody in the room says, "Hey, that's a wonderful idea," and put their money up and walked out of the room that night. I couldn't believe it, Larry, but everybody agreed on it, just like that.
Every now and then, reason prevails, and it shocks everybody.
June Beaver had been head of the United Auxiliaries, and she became the first woman elected to the board in 1971.
Let me ask you what the process was during those decades for developing new board members. How were board members chosen?
I wanted a board of 13 people. I didn't want 25 people on a board. You can't run a board with the 25 people. We would have a vacancy and we had a rotation. We set that up with the new corporate organization chart so that you would only serve for a period of time.
Were nominations made principally by you or by...
Well, by a committee of the board. There was usually the chairman of the board and somebody else, and three or four of us would get together and talk about, try to find somebody that had an expertise in one area or another area.
Well, Paul, let me switch gears just slightly here, because you and the board over the years presided over an enormous physical transformation of this institution. Could you just review very briefly, if you could, some of the major changes in the structure of the institution that have taken place over the years?
We had the Fonder Smith Student Nurses Residence on Frederick Street. We demolished that. Demolished the Lime Street building in 1973-74. We started the addition to the Stauffer Wing. We had methadone clinic where Rank's law offices was a gas station, and then we established that methadone clinic. We started the parking garage on Queen Street. We lost a construction worker on there. If you look, the two garages were the one that they tore all the way down and this one, and right in this alley back here, there's a big rock with a brass plaque on it about the young man that was crushed to death. I don't think a lot of people know that, but that's an unfortunate thing.
Well, let's move along now, because I do want to ask you about the campus. There are many things in your career that you can be proud of and that you could point to, and I imagine if I asked you what you would consider the greatest accomplishment, you might have a hard time naming just one. But to my mind, the campus has to stand out as something that is a legacy, that is a towering accomplishment for this institution. I was here during the years when it was discussed, yeah, proposed, and developed, and I know that it was far from being recognized immediately by everyone as a wise decision. So you had to move this thing through against opposition. So tell us about how you thought of it, what made you appreciate that the trends in medicine required this kind of shift towards outpatient facilities, and tell us about the acquiring the property and so forth.
We got the open heart surgery letter of intent was approved in 78-79. And then our service mark, you know, with the hands like that, that was adopted in 1980. CON in May of 81-82. And we got the trauma center designation. In the spring of 1990 or 91, I'm not sure what it was, I expressed to the board that it was my feeling that the way the practice of medicine was going, that it was more on an outpatient basis. I know when I came here in 1964, the average length of stay was 8 days. Now it's 4.5 days. The cost of medical care was increasing at such a rate that we were going to price ourselves out of the market. The board agreed, and the medical staff fully supported that we had to develop something for an outpatient basis, and we decided to buy some ground and as close to the institution and develop this outpatient facility. Finally, after struggling to find a piece of ground, it was 120 acres there at Roarstown Road and the Harrisburg Pike and 30 West.
Now you had to put together quite a number of parcels.
5 pieces of ground, and the smallest one was about 5 acres, which was owned by Dick Starr, and then the largest piece of property was, I think, owned by Mrs. Good. Mr. Good was the Good Drive, his name for him, and he used to be a East Hempfield Township Commissioner.
Now, first of all, it took a tremendous amount of vision to recognize that we ought to have that much land. Because at the beginning, that seemed 100 acres, seemed like a way over the top. And yet you looked at some smaller plots, a 40-acre lot, I know, out at Route 30 and New Holland Pike, yes, and pronounced it too small.
Yeah.
What were you thinking? You've obviously been proven to be exactly right, because there isn't much room for grass to grow out at the campus anymore. What were you thinking of when you realized that we ought to go for 100 acres?
When I bought the ground, I thought you measured the ground from the curb. No, you measured it from the center of the street. So part of my 120 acres is the Harrisburg Pike and the Royerstown Road now. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately. And as I said to you earlier, we purchased the property in kitchens, in the Adair kitchen, the Starr kitchen, and the Miller kitchen. Miller, Adair, Good, Gingrich, and Starr.
But what was it that made you go after that much property?
I thought it was the appropriate thing. I just had a feeling that that was the way to go.
You sure were right.
And I got criticized severely for it. People said that it was the Taj Mahal. Well, when you're sick and you're walking down a corridor, you don't want to rub shoulders with somebody. Then they finally understood that. And the board said you can't build a wing unless you got 60% leasing. And it got to the point where if Charlie Brown is in there, maybe I better get in there.
It was slow going at first until you kind of got a critical mass of doctors who wanted to locate there because everybody else was
there.
That's
exactly. It's like the car dealers all lined up with one another, or the five and dime stores all lined up with one to compete with one another, and they wanted in, and it just grew and grew and grew.
Yeah, well, they always say if you want to build a shoe store, you should build it right next to another shoe store, because that's where people go when they're looking for shoes. Let me just recapitulate the timeline now. You retired as the CEO of this hospital at age 65, mandatory retirement in 1992?
Yeah.
And that's when you directed your energies towards developing the campus,
right,
acquiring the property, hiring the architects, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then you directed the campus for a little over 2.5 years?
We started to build the campus in 1992. Paul Risk from Quarrywell was the general contractor. He started to develop the campus. He was done the end of July of 94, so that was almost 2 years and 8 months I spent with the construction and development of the campus. Now, just a couple of things. Where the entrance to the campus on the Harrisburg Pike, that was where Dick Starr lived, and there was a farmhouse there, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody said, oh, you can't tear that farmhouse down. It's antiquity. So I got Jack Luce, who was part of the Historical Society, and he went out there and examined it with me one day, and he said, Paul, there's no historical or architectural significance to this property, and I'll send you a letter, and et cetera, which he did do. And I went downtown, and I arranged to get the historical guy from the state or the city, I don't know who he was, and I drove him out there, and I said, now, you can have anything in this building you want. He looked around, and he got back in the car, and that was the end of it. And they tore the building down the next day. There was a guy from Franklin Marshall, some professor, where they did archaeological digs out there, you know, holes about a quarter of the size of this room, to see if there were any artifacts in the ground.
Indian artifacts. Native American.
No, and I had a bag of, and it was like somebody used to throw down the outhouse or down the well. That's about all we found. Pieces of old china and stuff like that. Nothing else.
Well, the campus at the time you envisioned as medical office buildings and some outpatient surgical facilities.
And the place to take care of little kitty, the children.
Well, now that's
daycare.
My next question.
Yeah.
Were those the buildings daycare that came later, were they already envisioned?
The daycare center was, but the balance of the buildings I had no part of.
The Women's and Babies Hospital,
no,
none of that was envisioned.
No.
You simply felt we needed to have a place where we could expand as needed.
Absolutely.
Well, this institution is a monument to providing for future needs. And I have to say that having come in 83, I'm glad I was able to work with you at least until 92 when you retired. So we had 9 years together, and we've had a very entertaining and insightful time with you here this morning, Paul. I want to thank you again, not only for coming here, but for what you've done for this hospital. Are there any people or entities that you especially want to mention before we wind this up?
I'd like to say two other things. I want to thank the board, the employees, the medical and dental staff, the United Auxiliaries, the Red Cross Grey Ladies, and the sewing ladies, and the mayors of the city of Lancaster. They supported me unquestionably over the years. That board and the medical staff and the doctors. Dick Mann was great. Ward O'Donnell, director of the lab. Dick Weber, family physician. Mike Rubin, cardiologist. Andy Koch in radiology. John Espenshade with us, starting the cath lab and then follow up with his family practice residents. Nick Cervantes, Jimmy Argiers, and John Polson in neurosurgery. I can remember when we went to the Steinmans for the operating microscope for the neurosurgeons. No question about it. And Willis Schenck, who was down at the newspaper, I'd come down there and he'd say, "What are you doing here now? What do you got your hand out for there now?" He used to criticize me. I'm going to miss somebody, I know that. But if I apologize to all of you, my friends on the
mountain. Well, Paul, that's typical, not wanting to leave anyone out. I have to say that this has been an extraordinary interview in many ways, not only because of your willingness to share your memories and perspectives, but because we've all had a chance to learn about a side of Paul Waddell we didn't know very well. I want to thank you again, and I know that I thank you on behalf of all of our listeners.